Welcome to the SEMO Marketing Podcast. I am back once again. It is the first podcast of 2025. And very quickly, a little bit about us. If you need to know who SEMO is, www.semoh.com, C-E-M-O-H. We basically do fractional marketing people. So if you need one of those in your business, come and talk to us. You can come and find me on LinkedIn. Come send me an email, simon@semoh.com. And if you like this podcast, please go and give us a nice rating on Spotify or iTunes and say something nice about us, because, you know, that's what we're all about. Saying nice things about people. But with all that out of the way, I am extremely lucky to have someone I've known for a very long time, and I've tried to get on this podcast for a number of months, and I want to stress, not through any fault of her own, it's just our ineptitude at organizing it. You're down in Sydney, aren't you?
I am, yes.
The absolutely fantastic Taryn Williams. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm good. First day back in the office, so catch me while I'm fresh. Good day.
Well, it's a good day to have Friday as the first day back in the office before you have the weekend. Yeah. Nice timing. Let's look. You're a multi-talented, multifaceted leader of business. I'm not going to blow too much smoke up your ass, because I'm sure you get enough of that as it is. But give us the kind. If we were going to do like a two-minute film trailer of your past, what would be the highlights? What bits are exploding? What's the funny gag reel? What's the 2 minute highlights of your illustrious career so far?
Oh, I love that. Actually, someone just sent me an AI prompt. I'll tag you in it on LinkedIn, where you put this AI prompt in to ChatGPT or Claude, and it gives you a visual depiction of your life. And it was quite, mine looks far more glamorous based on what ChatGPT knows about me. There's definitely not enough, you know, like there's not enough tears, there's not enough Excel spreadsheets for that to be an accurate description. So looks at a high level.
So is that the highlights of your life? Tears and Excel spreadsheets?
Tears and Excel spreadsheets, yeah. Yeah, shareholder agreements, Excel spreadsheets. Look, it's I guess my life is pretty interesting in that I traverse sort of a traditional, my first business, Wink Models, which is a traditional modeling agency, which is actually in a period of I would say upheaval and innovation at the moment, with Gen AI and some of our clients starting to work in that space, which I find really interesting. And then I went on to The Right Fit, which is a two-sided marketplace for creative talent, matching brands with all kinds of different creative talent, and the Influencers Agency. And I sold both of those businesses nearly 9-10 months ago now. And then Hash Gifted, which is a platform that connects brands and all different types of creators, influencers, content creators, UGC creators, in purely contra-only exchanges. Then I have Notable, the Speakers Bureau, and I'm just about to launch another business. I know, I'm crazy, which helps brands and creators, celebrities, talent connect for creators to be able to take an equity position in brands, essentially become shareholders and investors in the brand.
Gotcha.
And help them scale. So all of my sort of business interests have some degree of commercial similarities, in that they're based around talent, creators, social, and content creation, advertising, media, but lots of little nuances. And I think that the key difference being different business models behind them all. So a traditional full service agency, a marketplace, a SaaS business, back to almost a traditional agency.
Yeah. So, well, look, there's about 1,000 questions I have for you out of those 2 minute highlights. So, my first one would be, and a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of business owners are probably struggling with the same thing. You have run multiple businesses at the same time, and whilst they're all aligned, I would assume that some of them have, you know, different client bases, different staffing requirements, et cetera, How do you do that? Do you own them all like 100%, or are you doing that with partnerships, or what's And then, so the two-part question. Number one, how do you do it? And then number two, how do you then deal with the sort of thought in the back of your head that you're not giving those businesses 100% of your time?
Yeah, it's really hard. And there's definitely an opportunity cost too of being split across multiple projects. So Wink, I own 100%. The Right Fit, I had venture capital investors as well as some strategic investors, Havas and some international holding groups that invested in the business. And then the other two businesses I own outright as well. I will raise capital for one of those in the sort of coming 6 to 12 months. So look, it's really hard is the short answer. There is no silver bullet. Like, it's for probably the last 10 years, I've worked 12 to 16 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week. Fast solution to that. I stepped out of the Wink business day to day about 8 years ago, and I have a fantastic team in that business. That business is a little bit easier because it is a traditional agency business. I built a big tech product that manages all of the end-to-end onboarding, calendar management, payroll integration, a custom booking system for that business, which gives me a lot of visibility, a lot of data, sort of removes a lot of the opportunity for human error and key man dependence in that business, and allowed it to scale without my involvement. So that business, touch wood, operates really well without me. I think tech businesses are much harder beast. Fast growth, high growth tech companies require a very, very different skill set and a very different team. And that, you know, that involves engineers, it involves product managers, data analysts, you know, so it's a very different build, which is really hard. It's really hard finding the right people for those roles. They're expensive. Yeah. And then you're sort of juggling getting the sales and marketing function of that business to communicate and work with the product and engineering side of that business is sort of where the friction I find always comes. And then, yes, it's about looking at where are there market opportunities that I can start and scale businesses, and can I bring in the right executional and operational people from a day-to-day basis to make that happen? Because I always say I have a very narrow, deep skill set, and I'm very good at 0 to 2 years in a business, and then, you know, it requires sort of an operational team that are much more interested in systems, processes, that, you know, where I sort of maybe lose my interest a little bit. And so I think I recognize now where my strengths and weaknesses are as a founder, as an entrepreneur, and as a leader. And I'm much more inclined to bring in COOs, CEOs, head of product, those sort of roles earlier in the journey. Even though they can be very expensive hires, the likelihood of the success of the company sort of far outweighs
There's a couple of things there that you've said that I think I've learned sort of, especially in the last couple of years, is that, you know, businesses that have a very sort of narrow focus, I think, tend to do better. So businesses that come to the party with, hey, we do this one thing and we do this one thing really well. So you kind of mentioned the modeling agency. It's a traditional modeling agency. It's not going outside of its lane. That's what that thing does, and it does it really well. And I would imagine things like, you know, Notable and Gifted and all those kind of things, they're going, we do this one thing and we're going to do it really well. We're not going to try and be all things to all people. Is that sort of in your head when you're thinking about these ideas?
Yeah, definitely. And I think with The Right Fit, I went far too broad too quickly. Like, it was a marketplace for creative talent, and we should have started with just potentially a marketplace for actors, or a marketplace for actors and models. But we were, you know, built a marketplace for photographers, models, actors, influencers, stylists, social media, you know, the whole nine yards. And that taught me a lot about, one, the cost to acquire a customer effectively on both sides of that marketplace. When there was geographic dependencies as well. So yes, I think it taught me a lot about getting really clear on your value proposition and what part of a puzzle you're solving for a customer. And I think getting cut through is very, very difficult in this landscape. Capturing attention of a busy, most of my businesses speak to CEOs, marketers, capturing that attention of those people is really, really challenging. Mm. So I think the simpler and cleaner you can make that value proposition and the piece of the puzzle that you're solving for them, I think the better.
The other thing I've learned in the last couple of years as well is about when you obviously you've got that, you know, what I've called many times entrepreneurial ADD, where you're just going, hey, there's a good idea, let's do this.
And
you know, like Homer Simpson, where he's like thinking of something else, and he's, you know, the monkey's bashing the cymbals next to it. Yeah, anyway, you know, that kind of thing where you're completely distracted with another good idea. It's where he chases after a poodle, doesn't it, down the road? That's where he goes. Yeah. But my point is one of the things that I've sort of found is that if I try and split my time, and this is just, you know, this is just me, but if I try and split my time across two companies and two organizations, I tend to do both of them badly. One thing we've kind of realized, and by we, I mean me and my business partner, is that if we go and create another entity that does something very specific, we're now trying to do that in partnership with somebody we trust and giving them straight away ownership, share ownership, leadership, putting them in a leadership role. And then our job is to then support them. Our job is business development, growth, marketing, the things that we know we're good at, you know, operational, you know, streamlining things, and then leaving it to them to run the business, with just us being that kind of support network to make it easier for them. So, there's no right answer to these things, but that's just the way that I found. If I could do five companies each with a strong owner leader in that we could just support, that for me, I find a lot easier.
Yeah. And finding those people that have the risk appetite, the skill set and the desire to run and own something is really challenging, because I think everyone has maybe quite a blissfully naive idea of what running effectively most of these businesses start as a startup, despite how much sort of resource you might wrap around them. It does require like a lot of grit and tenacity. I think probably something that I realized over the last 12 months in trying to do that model of bringing in business partners into a project and a CEO very early into a project, it definitely can succeed. It's never going to succeed at the rate and pace of a founder-led business. And I think that's just a you can't replace founder energy. And I think that comes from both usually the deep domain expertise that a founder brings to a business. And that being across all of the elements in a startup requires you to be able to go from 30,000 foot to 3 foot really, really quickly. And to be able to work between that is quite a rare skill set. Yeah, I think it can work, and I think my learning is it just doesn't happen as quickly as you might like, and I'm certainly maybe not the most patient person, so it's been a learning experience for me as to, I guess that opportunity cost of going, I could go all into one project 150% because that's the only way I know how to do things, and, you know, potentially get it to scale more quickly, or I can sort of work across a diversified portfolio of things and accept that, you know, they're going to take a little bit longer to get there.
Talk to me about, you know, influencers has been part of your life. I guess models right at the start, models are influencers. That's kind of what they originally were. And I think some of the original influencers that, you know, we might look back in when I was growing up all those years ago in the 80s and the 90s, you know, were largely models or, you know, pop stars or things like that. Yeah. I mean, obviously that's shifted massively in the past five, 10 years. What's the state of play? And we'll come and talk about AI in a minute, because AI is, I think, it's its own conversation, but is it still, are brands still using, is influencer strategy still a valid, you know, strategy, and how's it sort of changed in the last few years?
Yeah, look, definitely. It's still a very valid strategy, and brands are definitely increasing their spend in that space. And I think it comes down to a few things. I think the nuances within that have changed a lot. So it's sort of shifted away from the vanity metrics of, you know, people with a very high number of followers. We then moved into people who were very influential within particular niches and had a voice of authority in that particular space. You know, so whether it was naturopaths or, you know, a very niche mummy influencer in a particular field or whatever it might be. And so I think, you know, we've continued to see that shift. We've continued to see brands get more and more savvy around the measures that matter. So being able to think about, am I using this person for sort of a brand halo effect? You know, am I associating with them because they are a person of profile, or am I looking for conversions, or am I looking for content? You know, those can all form a part and should form a part of a good influencer strategy, and that you're probably not going to get all of those things from one person. You would build sort of a diversified portfolio of people who are really good at UGC, really have a fantastically engaged audience and drive conversions, and then people who are sort of getting you that top of funnel reach and more positive brand sentiment. So I think, you know, we've started to see more of an education in that space, which is great because you're seeing campaigns that have better success and, you know, drive conversions and also feel more authentic to a customer or a potential customer. So I think definitely that's been a really positive shift. I think probably with the uncertainties around the platforms at the moment, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. You know, I think if we do see TikTok banned, that's going to be, you know, cause a lot of uncertainty for brands around how they execute. And I think, you know, with TikTok Shop was obviously wildly popular in other markets. I think Australian brands are really looking forward to how that might translate for conversions here. So TBC, whether or not we're going to get that. I think it's also made creators much more conscious about how they build and where they build their audiences. Because as you can imagine, there's a huge fear out there in the creator world at the moment of people who have built, you know, an audience of 2 million, 3 million followers on TikTok that now they don't own. You know, and so there's platforms like Substack and Discord, and, you know, where you can actually own that first party data. You own the relationship with your followers and you can move them to different platforms. And I think probably the last piece is just that we're starting to see brands really think more cohesively about longer term, deeper relationships with creators. It's really popular in the US now to bring influencers, creators, celebrities on board as advisors to a company, building them out as part of your creative team and creative suite, because they deeply understand the customer base and they understand best practices on platforms. So it allows them to sort of deliver much more value than just engaging them on a transactional campaign by campaign basis, actually working in a deeper, sort of more meaningful way with those people over a longer term basis as both influencers and as both sort of advisors, board members, fractional experts in the company. So I think we'll start to see more of a shift to that as well as it sort of, it allows creators and influencers to really deeply understand the brand narrative, their tone of voice, guidelines, and be able to proactively work with them in driving success, whether, you know, across a much broader range of things, you know, whether that's conversions, newsletter signups, creative direction, brand repositioning, sort of much more meaningful, richer relationship.
One of the areas, and again, it'd be interesting to see whether you think this is a growth area, and this is going to sound incredibly selfish as a member of Generation X, but I feel there's a growth opportunity in that Gen X influencer, because they are in an age group now where a lot of them, not me, but a lot of them, the kids are left home, they have high disposable incomes, they want to spend that incomes on things that they were doing when they were in their 20s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like I've got a group of people that are going to some sort of first time, a daytime clubbing event in Brisbane next weekend or something like that, where we're going to listen to all the music that we were listening to you know, in the 90s and the early 2000s, but we're doing it, and then it finishes at 9 o'clock. So we can all be in bed by 10 o'clock, you know. I find the two things is that there's this kind of gradual rise of Gen X influencers, and that's been very prevalent, I think, on TikTok, because I spend a lot of time on TikTok. I really enjoy the platform. It's an educational platform. But I see a lot of TikTok influencers in that Gen X space now. And I also think your point about people moving to platforms where they control the narrative and the data. So Discord has had huge growth in the last few years. Yeah. But even WhatsApp groups now are just, you know, blowing up. I mean, I'm in one where there's maybe 70, 80 people in, and if there's an event on in a particular city, there's certain people within that group who are influencing the rest of the group to go to those events. Now, that's all being done in a completely closed system. How do brands tap into that? Because, you know, there's brands that don't even know those influencers exist.
And I love that you mentioned that, because I think people have a really contrived idea when they think about influencers. They think like someone on TikTok or Instagram who has a high social following, or YouTube, you know. And I think it's so much more than that. There's so many, like, you know, Pinterest is the second largest referrer of search traffic after Google. Like, there's so many other platforms, WhatsApp, WeChat, that you can be thinking of if you're thinking strategically. Like, I'm a big fan of Reddit. And Reddit influencers are so powerful. And Reddit hijacking of threads is so powerful, especially in, like, the B2B space. Like, if you're looking for platform recommendations of a SaaS tool, or, you know, there is Reddit forums completely dedicated to this kind of space, and the ability to have influential Reddit people talking about your product or service in those right space, right time can really move the meter. So I think thinking more holistically and more broadly about where your brand can show up and what's relevant I think when you sort of carve influencer marketing out to a couple of, like, who is the person that can really drive a meaningful conversation about your brand? And then where is the right place for your brand to show up? And that's often, you know, I think a lot of people, especially when they think about B2B brands, they're like, oh, well, you know, it can only be LinkedIn. Or, you know, there's a very limited number of places in certain publications or whatever. And I always try to get them to step back and say, like, at the end of the day, the people that you're trying to influence, whether they're CEOs, COOs, CTOs, they're still people at the end of the day. And so they're still consuming content in other places. So where is a relevant way? It might be networking clubs. It might be WhatsApp groups, as you said. You know, it might be podcasts. Like, you know, I think the US election was a massive example of how influential podcasts were in shifting a narrative.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, when you think about that, it's an incredibly powerful way for brands to go, okay, well, yes, what is the content that is consumed by and on what platforms by the people that I'm trying to influence?
And I think, again, be interested in your opinion on this, but I think you mentioned their networking clubs. I think there seems to me to be a growth, certainly as we sort of exited COVID and certainly in the last 2 years, of people going, hey, I want to network again face to face with people that I have, you know, similarities or have something in common and all those kind of things. But I want it to be good. And I think before COVID, there was this, just, you know, you'd rock up to a drinks and it was just boring as batshit, and the speaker was boring, and it was all like you never really actually got to meet anybody because you went in and someone said hello to you and then you got stuck talking to them for the next 2 hours.
Yeah.
But I think people want that human connection again, and they go, I want to go to a lunch, but I want it to be interesting. I want it to be really engaging or fun, and I want to, you know, and then I want to meet everyone in the room as well. Do you see more of that happening?
Yeah, and actually it's funny that you mentioned that. So Chris Wirashina, one of the co-founders of Pedestrian, and I host this quarterly, it's called the Season Opener, quarterly get-together, basically designed exactly for that. We've done it for probably 7-8 years now, but essentially it's a highly curated opportunity to get people in a room together that across media, arts, entertainment, tech, startups, in a room, 30 to 40 people, highly curated experience, no sponsors, a guest speaker, And we've tried to build it in a way that we can guarantee for the people that come and, you know, come on that night that they're going to meet really interesting people, they're going to learn something, and they're going to leave without feeling like they've been sold to. And it came out of both Chris and I's need and desire to have those experiences ourselves. And, you know, you get invited to a multitude of different sort of branded events, and not saying that, you know, branded events are in any way bad, but it definitely limits the organicness of how an evening can run and unfold. And there is such a need and such a desire for humans to connect and connect with people in a meaningful way that feels deep and engaging and authentic in a short period of time, you know. So, yes, I definitely think the rise of, and I think especially, you know, before we get into the big deep hole of AI, especially as we start to see more and more Gen AI content, people like losing trust in what they see online, I think the value of human connections and experiences is only going to rise over the next 3 to 5 years.
I've been running a lunch, sort of quarterly lunch. It's now sort of 3 times a year since for the past 3 years as well. We've got our next one coming up for International Women's Day on March the 8th. One of the things I did at the end of it, and I started just because I'm a nerd like this, was doing a quiz, doing a team quiz at the end of every session. So sort of about 2:15 to 3:00, we do a table quiz. There's 20 questions, and the winning table, you know, wins nothing other than the recognition that they've won. What we found with that is that the tables were then made up of people that, all the teams were made up of people that didn't know each other. So they were all then arguing about the answers to the questions and things like that. And it was really engaging. And there's been some events where we, for the table winner, we got them, I went to the local medal shop and got them little medals to hang around their necks. At the end of the event, we're talking about corporate people here, all in, you know, shirts and suits and things like this. And they're all taking a team photo with their medals on to post on LinkedIn. And like these medals may have cost me $5 to make, you know what I mean? But it was all of a sudden, it was that sort of, it was engaging and it was fun and it was, people were being stupid and everyone was shouting at each and swearing at each other. And all of a sudden this was like, yeah, this is not a normal networking event. This is absolute anarchy. But that's what stands it apart from everything else. So people, and people know what they're getting. You know, they know that by the time I'm doing the quiz at 2:15, I'm probably going to be pissed as well. So I'm going to be swearing a bit and it's going to be, you know. So I think if people want to create that brand, I mean, you say, you know, branded events, sometimes they have a bad name, but I think if your brand is there to go, hey, I'm here to help you guys have a good time or meet some new people, I think people go, I want to be part of that. I think that's something genuinely people want.
And I think, look, you see a lot of brands doing it really, really well too, you know, where they are like taking a step back and going, instead of just having the big launch party or the, you know, the big launch event, how can we create really amazing, meaningful experiences that people are going, that are not necessarily just targeting influencers either and getting, you know, a bunch of media and whatever in the room, actually getting really targeted and thinking about who are our target customer that we want to take on this experience. Like I think it was Land Rover did the takeover at Hayman Island for and, you know, that was a really great example of creating a, you know, 3 or 4 day beautiful boutique experience, taking up some high net worth, some media, some influencers, and creating something that really got cut through as opposed to having just another launch party. So I think doing things like that where you're considered in the narrative that you're trying to weave about the brand and that you are a part of the conversation but not the whole conversation.
Let's talk about AI just because I'm cognizant of time here, but you've obviously been playing around with AI a lot. I think anyone who with a half a marketing brain has been playing around with AI and should be playing around with AI. My partner, who's a lawyer, has been playing around with software and she's sort of saying, hey, this is helping me, you know, do 10 times the amount of work on any given contract or whatever. Using a tool that helps her construct contracts that would normally take her hours and hours to do. What's two-part question, where do you see it going? That's question number one. And the second part of the question is, what have you been playing around with that you've just gone, fucking hell, that's amazing?
Yeah, okay. So I think that we are going to see a couple of big problems. Like my main concerns, so I've been on the deep dive of AI for probably about 2 years now. Started with reading a lot from sort of Mo Gaudat and people that were maybe a little bit more skeptical or concerned about, you know, Tristan Harris and people like that, about the outcomes of what, you know, especially some of these advances in Gen AI could look like. So I probably started as a little bit more of a skeptic than I did, or having, you know, broader concerns than I've probably got to now. I think that we are going to have some concerns about how, especially the generation coming after us, don't maybe have the critical thinking or the understanding of validating information and content. And that really worries me. Just when we start to see more and more content that is fake content, fake news, how we are going to, you know, restore any sort of trust in democracy, how we're going to have a functioning society, how we're not going to just have more and more polarization on both ends of the scale. So, you know, more broadly at a macro level, that's the sort of stuff that really worries me. I think from a practical day-to-day level, I think everyone in whatever industry you're in, you really need to get across how AI is going to impact your personal and professional life. I think there's so many opportunities. It is moving so, so quickly. I dedicate Sunday afternoon, 3 hours to sit down and get on top of all of my AI tools that have come out that week, the new agents, reading articles, blah, 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 because it is just moving at such an exponential rate. And I try and remind myself that this is how our parents must have felt when the internet came out and they're like, oh my God, what do you mean? You can bank online. Like, oh Jesus Christ. Like, you know, what does this mean for all of us? And instead of being fearful of it, just embracing that, you know, there's going to be parts of it that are going to be really, really useful. And I hope that it's going to be jobs accretive, not destructive. So I've been trying to get into a lot of the generative AI platforms, Runway, you know, some of these platforms that are making really quick advancements in the space. It is truly terrifying how much they've changed in the last 6 months, 8 months.
Yeah.
I have no doubt that brands will start to use these platforms for a lot of their content creation. My broader concern with that is, how is that going to impact the social platforms? How is it going to impact how we consume content as consumers, as human beings, which I don't think anyone has an answer for yet. And I'm a deep lover of Claude, of ChatGPT, of Perplexity. It's just radically transformed how I do my job. Instead of having to wait and be reliant on a data analyst, for example, to pull some analysis for me, I can get a whole bunch of unstructured data, just data dump exports from my team, and I can go and use ChatGPT to query that data. I don't need to spend time categorizing it, sorting it, putting in this is the customer ID, this is the sign up date, whatever it might be. And I can ask ChatGPT, for example, to find the correlations in that data, to do a cohort analysis for me, to come back to me with things that I wouldn't even think of to question that data. So I'm using ChatGPT and Claude, you know, are now an essential part of my day. I can't fathom how I operated without them. I do think that it's going to make people who use these tools much more effective, it frees my time up to spend more time on creative ideation that I don't think sort of ChatGPT is necessarily there yet, than it does in doing sort of practical, you know, very rote repeat tasks that are less of a value add. And it allows us to, especially in the startups, to just move far more quickly, especially things like code completion tools, QA tools. You know, it just allows us to deploy far more code than we could have, you know, at scale.
My business partner, in terms of writing code, has sort of said he's now, it's like having another developer working with him in terms of, you know, the volume that he can get done. So, is there anything that sort of, if you were going to say to everybody, hey, go and check this tool out, what's perhaps your favorite AI tool that you've seen, even if it's very sort of niche, or even if it's not quite where it should be, you know,
I think Runway is pretty amazing. Like, just the fact that you can create pretty impressive video content with zero, like, you don't need to have any sort of coding engineering background. You know, back in the, probably if you started playing with Sora, like, you could make some pretty basic stuff there, but Runway is pretty damn incredible in very limited prompts that you need. You don't need to be a prompt engineer. You don't need to have a deep understanding to be able to create something really, really impressive. So, I've been thoroughly enjoying playing with that. I've also thoroughly been enjoying making AI twins of myself. There's a whole bunch of tools out there that you can do that
with. Yes, I've seen an AI twin of you.
Yeah, you've probably seen it. And just that they're getting so bloody good, you know, it is mildly terrifying. It does make me think a lot about deep fakes and, you know, where does that end? And I was actually talking to someone recently who's a sort of expert in this space, who was saying you absolutely must have like a family safe word. Like, you must have something that if you are calling and speaking to your parents, there is a word that is used before any sort of, which, you know, I was like, well, I really probably need to do that with my family, probably with your team as well, because we are getting to that point where it's so easy to, you know, from a 3-second clip, recreate voice, create, you know, very plausible video content. So,
that's such a great idea, and you know, that's the first time I've heard that, and I think if people only take one thing away from this conversation, that idea of a family safe word for. And someone with a, you know, I've got a 6-year-old and an almost 9-year-old, and I can't imagine the technology that they're going to be exposed to in 5-6 years.
I think it fundamentally changes, you know, what we need to be teaching in schools, or even the relevance of the, you know, current education system. I
often have arguments about whether we need to teach kids to write.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here writing notes about, you know, about what we're talking about. But, you know, I haven't written notes in a meeting for 6 months. I use a note taker. I use Granola largely. Yeah. But all of a sudden I've seen, we do all of our meetings on Google Meet, and now Google Meet have implemented their own internal one. And so I'm just clicking a button and it's doing it all for me, which is fantastic.
Into action items. Tick, tick, tick.
I'll tell you what, and you might be able to help me here. I still can't find a solution for a note taker for a person, a face-to-face meeting, where I can just leave my phone on the table and the phone picks up the different voices and transcribes it and sends it to me later on and identifies the different people talking.
No, the only one I know of, I don't know what it's called, but it's a physical device, like a, which I've seen a few people use. I don't know how effective it is. I haven't been using it. Yes, I only use it mine for online meets. And it does make you realize afterwards, doesn't it? The number of times I slack myself in when I'm in face-to-face meetings, little reminders of like, must do this, must do that, because otherwise I'll forget. It does make you realize how much more
effective. I think that would be a massive opportunity, something that I could, you know, that uses your phone microphone and just picks up all that. You know, conversation, and then sends that to you later on. Because I'm still sitting with a client asking them what they need and still having to write down notes. I'm like, okay, we should we should have done this on Google Meet, and then I could have got someone to make these notes for me. But look, last question, just because I'm conscious of time. And this might be a bit of a prickly question. Feel free not to answer this. What have you missed out on? What have you missed out on? Because I see you working all the time, and I'll be the first to put my hand up. I simply do not have the dedication of someone like you. I cannot, I cannot work to that level. And I sometimes kick myself, but I see my brother work to that level. My brother has sort of worked 16-hour days for most of his life and just driven. I do not have that dedication. What have you, if you could go back, would you do something different? Would you, you know, what have you feel that you've not got from oh everything you've achieved?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I often say, like, sometimes your only purpose in life is to serve as like a warning sign to others, because yeah, sometimes I'm like, this is,
that's a very good motivational quote, that sometimes, yeah.
Like, Jesus, it's not easy, you know, and I was just saying to someone the other day, the visual representation of my life on Instagram and TikTok is very different to when I blog and write. It's, you know, I think a lot more real about sort of the struggles and the challenges, and I don't know quite yet how to make those two align. But, oh, my God, I've had to give up so many things. I mean, it's been the absolute destroyer of a number of my personal relationships, absolutely.
No.
I've done a lot of time away from my family, both, you know, because of work, and then traveling because of work, so being in different states and countries to them. I don't have children. I'm 39. So, like, you know, it's something I probably need to think about if I'm going to tackle that. But it just hasn't – I simply have not had the capacity to be able to do that. So it comes with a huge number of personal sacrifices. And I think on reflection, I think there's probably a naivety to how long something's going to take to build and how all-consuming it's going to be. And, you know, definitely, like, how long the process of selling the Right Fit and the Influencers Agency was going to take, you know, and how all-consuming that is as well from a time and an emotional capacity perspective. So, yeah, I mean, I think you have to be really – and one of the reasons that I'm sort of taking this – not doing very well, but sort of 3 month, 4 month sabbatical. It was supposed to be a 12-month sabbatical, but I've kind of really failed at that. But sabbatical is to really deeply question, do I want to, and do I have the capacity and desire to go all in on something again, knowing the opportunity cost, knowing that it will mean the impact on my health, my relationships, having to make a very conscious decision that will be, okay, well, that means you're not going to have children. It means... So, yeah, it's an incredibly can be a very lonely journey and a very, very taxing journey. And it's why a number of people come to me and say, like, oh, I want to start a business. And I'm like, do you really? Or do you want to be – there is absolutely no shame in being an entrepreneur. Like, do it within an organization. Do it within your PwC or your Westpac, where you can lead an idea, you can build out a great team, but you get 4 weeks annual leave and you get sick leave. And, you know, that's – really something to be said for that. So the the startup world.
Yeah, I feel, to me, you know, the age of my kids at 6 and 9 was to me, it was important to make sure when they're with me, which is sort of week on, week off, that I'm dropping them at school. I'm picking them up from school. I'm watching all their sports stuff and I'm coaching their football teams and all those kind of things. And I go, the sacrifice then for me is that I can't be as present at work as I would potentially like to. I can't go to as many meetings. I can't have as many, you know, conversations with prospects and clients and take on those opportunities. So, you know, it's funny. You kind of see, I look at it the other way around, because I look at my brother. I look at, you know, the what you've achieved, and I go, I could have done that. If I, you know, do you know what I mean? Everyone I think has to sacrifice something, you know, for success. And first of all, you need to define what that success is. And it changes different times of your life and things like that. But everybody has to sacrifice something somewhere.
Totally. And when is enough enough as well? You know, my mentor is frequently like, you know, why roll the dice again, you know, and why not? And, you know, I think a lot of it is taking stock and actually reflecting on, I'm really good at commercial success. I know how to do that. Like, just work harder, you know, do more, apply more time, energy, resources, you know, things go up and to the right. A lot of other things in life don't work that way. Your relationship with your children, you know, building a relationship with a partner, your health doesn't necessarily correlate, you know, the time, energy, investment is not necessarily going to be up and, you know, give you the result that you want. So it's a lot scarier to go and bite off those things that you're maybe not naturally as good at, or that you don't have as much control over the outcome. So I definitely think I've got a personal resistance to, like, I'll just do another startup instead of, like, actually, you know, going and dating or things that I suck at.
But then I would also say, and this would be my advice to you, since we're now turning into a D&M
therapy here, session.
But I talk to my parents are visiting me from the UK at the moment. My father talks to my brother, who's younger than me, 3 years younger than me. And my brother still works all the time. He's traveling a lot. He was in the Middle East 2 weeks ago. He's pretty much all over the world, right? Mm-hmm. And he's putting together these big, he's in resource exploration. So, you know, he owns his own company and all those kind of things. And my dad's kind of had those conversations with him in the past that why don't you step back from it? It's like, you know, what's enough? How much, you know, how far do you need to keep pushing this? You don't need any more money. You've got, you know, you could retire tomorrow and be fine. And I think my brother says something that I think probably holds true with you, is that he turns around and said, I really enjoy doing this. Mm. And I don't think you just be ashamed to sit there and say, I enjoy this. This is what I get motivated in. I like starting businesses. I like that first 2 years. I want to keep doing that and not feel that you have to apologize that I'm going to go and start another business, and just sit there and say, that is what drives me on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a natural sort of personality trait of the seeing ideas, seeing opportunities, and then just not being able to squash that desire to go and try and solve them. Like the bottom drawer of ideas that I constantly say, like, oh, if only execution wasn't the problem, if only it was just, you know, ideation was the hard part. So yeah, I think you're right in that I think some people just, it's the way we're wired. It's just whether or not that ends up with a holistic, happy, healthy life at the end of it is
the million dollar question. True. There was a great quote I heard on a Tim Ferriss podcast when I used to listen to Tim Ferriss years and years ago, and I never remember who the quote was from because it was one from his guest, and he said, the best way to be successful and rich and have everything you want is to have one really, really good idea and then never, ever have another one. And I'm
so
like,
true. So true.
So true.
Yes. Yeah. Quit
while thank you very much for... Thank you for being on the show. Where can people, if people want to talk to you and annoy you, or they want your help or whatever, where's the best place for them to come and find you?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn. It's just Taryn Williams. You can contact me via my website as well, which is just tarynwilliams.com.au, or on any of the social platforms. So, Insta, TikTok, all the usual places.
Awesome. Thank you very much for today. Now we've done this once, we'll have to do this again. And maybe we should do this because I want to find a little group of people where we can talk shit about brands. So, like, you know, because I'm sure you've got an opinion about things like Jaguar and, you know, all those kind of brands that are doing all these kind of things that you sit there and just look at them and go, Jesus, is that, Anyway, thank you very much for today. Lovely to see you again. I'll talk to you soon. Yeah,
such a pleasure.